not our usual theme music here on KLW for Open Air. That's Webb Wiggins on the harpsichord. He's appearing with the San Francisco Early Music Society Dark Horse Concert in concerts Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. The studio is crowded with musicians that are involved in that very concert, and we'll have the pleasure of some live music in a moment. Also this hour on Open Air, actor Andrew Nance talks about his leading role in Harbor at the New Conservatory Theater. Soprano Ruth Zizak visits. She's soloist with the San Francisco Symphony this weekend for performances of Brahms' Ein Deutsches Requiem under the direction of conductor laureate Herbert Blomstedt. Also, I'll have a talk with composer Jake Heggie about his production at the Yerba Buena Center under the auspices of Opera Parallel of Dead Man Walking with a libretto by Terrence McNally. That work had its premiere some 15 years ago under the auspices of the San Francisco Opera. Plus a live performance, as I mentioned, of 17th century Germany via Dark Horse. They're performing this weekend. So let's start right in with some music by Dark Horse, and then we'll be talking in a moment with Greg Ingalls about the concerts. Here is Es steht Gott auf, music of Heinrich Schütz. Harpsichordist Webb Wiggins, plus Jolie Greenleaf and Molly Quinn on vocals, cornetists Kiri Tollickson and Nathaniel Cox performing that music of Heinrich Schütz, Es steht Gott auf, from Sinfonie Sacre, the second book of which. That's to be performed this weekend under the auspices of the San Francisco Early Music Society, Dark Horse Consort, Unbroken Consort, The Marriage of Voice and Brass in the 17th Century. Here to talk a bit about that, those concerts, is the director of the ensemble, Greg Ingles. Greg, welcome to Open Air. Let me get your proper microphone on here. There you are. Hi.
Thank you for having us.
That's such a glorious sound that we're treated to in a live studio environment. It's pretty amazing.
It's one of my favorites, especially with the cornets and the voices together. You get all the high brass with the high singers. And that's the whole point of the concert, is having this mixture of voice and instrument where they blend so well together that it doesn't seem like two separate entities, but just one group that plays together that's one magic sound.
Well, let's talk about that kind of inside baseball terminology that we have going on in the title here, in parentheses, Broken Consort. Explain to our audience what it's meant by a broken consort, and then why this one is unbroken.
That's a good question. You'll have the consort, or the idea of the consort, is a group of instruments or voices that all go together, or a family of instruments. So if you have, say, singer, soprano, alto, tenor, bass, that's a consort of voices. Or you have violin, viola, cello, double bass, that's a consort of violins. And we have here a consort of brass, which is the cornetti on top and the three sackbuts or trombones on the bottom. But with this music, or if we play it in such a way, if the brass play very vocally or the singers could have matched the instrumental lines, you have this unbroken consort. Broken consort means mixtures of different consorts, but we can together sound really like one unified whole. And you heard that at the beginning, that the cornetti in the Eschtegott Auf sounded trumpety, and when the singers came in, they tried to match trumpet calls, like calls of war. And then later in the triple section, they sang a ciccone all together, and the virtuosity of the vocalist was taken over by the cornets, and they had the same lines, just kind of having a conversation back and forth, not like two separate entities, but two similar ones, just like call and response, basically.
Hmm. Interesting. And I'm fascinated by the cornets, and I'd like maybe could Kerry talk a little bit about the instrument themselves? They're interesting to look at. It kind of like looks like a keyless oboe that's been left out in the sun and kind of warped a little bit. That's my impression. But it's the sound sounds very brass-like. Now, why do we get a brass sound out of something that would look like it would be producing a woodwind sound?
Well, the cornetto is truly a hybrid.
Better describe the instrument too than
what I just said. A hybrid instrument. It's a combination between woodwind techniques and brass techniques. For those of you out in radio land who can't see the instrument that I'm holding up.
Well, hold it up closer to the microphone.
If I hold it up closer, it's curved. It actually evolved from an animal horn. And what they would have done is taken an animal horn, hollowed it out, and had one end where you could blow into. Now, an animal horn was only had one or two notes it could produce. At some point, someone was brilliant enough to actually construct out of wood a instrument that was similar but had was fully chromatic. So the cornetto, it's made out of wood, hand carved out of wood. It has finger holes like a recorder, and that's its woodwind technique. And it has a very small cup-shaped mouthpiece that we vibrate our lips into, and that's the reference to a brass instrument. And so you have these qualities of both more prominent brassy sound, but also more of a smooth, more vocal sound. And unfortunately, this instrument didn't evolve into anything else. So it has not changed
something
in the last 400 years. And it was known actually in the 17th century for its resemblance to the human voice. It was considered the instrument that most resembled the human voice, and so part of its construction, that's why it's able to blend so well with the human voice, but also with many other instruments as well.
And this particular instrument, when was this made, and what is it made of?
This particular instrument is made out of ironwood and was just made maybe 7 years ago by a very fine player and maker in Montreal.
So most instruments now are then modeled after the
they are.
Instruments.
We don't have any playable original instruments.
Why is that?
The good instruments that were used back then, they tend to decay over time.
Don't we all?
There are some original There are some original instruments that exist, though, in original condition, but because of posterity, we keep them that way and don't play them.
Mm-hmm. And Nathaniel's instrument is a little bit different from yours, yes?
Yes. One thing I failed to mention is it's carved out of wood, but then covered with leather. Mine is covered with leather, and Nathaniel has an instrument that's covered with parchment.
Interesting. And does that affect the sound at all? Nathaniel, do you have a different sense of
I don't know
sound?
That the wrapping makes much difference. Different wood, you know, might make a difference in the color. And it's mainly the individual player.
Mm-hmm. And let's just talk a minute with Webb, if we could, about the harpsichord. Oh, stay there, Webb. We could probably pick you up on that microphone.
Okay.
It's absolutely, again, I wish this was more a visual element this afternoon, because that's an absolutely gorgeous instrument. Tell us about the instrument that you're playing.
The instrument is a copy of a Flemish, probably 17th century design. The soundboard is highly decorated in flowers and arabesques. The exterior is pretty simple. It oftentimes is a marbleized painting. And the lid inside and all the inside workings are paper covered. The lid is papered to look like wood. Of course, it's paper on wood to look like wood. Interesting. And it is both iron and brass strung.
And single keyboard?
Single keyboard, but there's a set of strings that are at what I would call piano pitch, 8-foot pitch, or if you're organists, and there's also one at 4-foot, which I'm not using because I don't need it. The instrument is strong enough to support these people without needing for me to be overpowered.
Sure, and you actually brought it into our studio today. KLW doesn't have a harpsichord, resident harpsichord. And it's right. And that's another virtue of the harpsichord versus the piano.
It's a very portable instrument, usually,
exactly.
Some more than others. This is really quite nice. It's not iron-framed. Basically, everything about this construction is wooden, except the strings.
Hmm. So, and for folks that don't know the difference between a piano and a harpsichord, it's a plucked instrument.
It's a plucked
rather than
instrument.
A struck.
Yeah, at the end of the key, which is only a lever, sits a jack, a little piece of wood, and sticking out of the jack is a plectra, originally bird quill.
So let's hear just how that sound happens there. Marvelous stuff. Thanks so much. Let's hear some more music while we're all assembled here. We're going to hear next, I believe, some music of Alessandro Orologio, who lived from 1550 to 1633. Here is the Entrade Cinque et Sex Vocibus. Something like that. We'll work on that pronunciation later when we get Greg back on the microphone. More music from the Dark Horse Consort from the San Francisco Early Music Society. Hit it, guys.
Thank you.
music of Alessandro Orologio that's being presented by Dark Horse Concert under the auspices of the San Francisco Early Music Society. Greg, if I could get you to come back on the mic a little bit and help me with my horrible pronunciation of that last work. And we do have a little bit of time left for to get our vocalists on mic as well, so maybe you can introduce this next one so I don't stumble over that one.
Sure. So this last piece was the Entrada number 4 from Orologio's set of entradas for 5 and 6 voices. Entrada de Quinque e Sei Vocibus.
See, it's not that easy, yeah, is it? Exactly. All right, I feel better now.
No, from his first book of entradas. Our next piece is... actually, give the title.
We're shuffling musicians and music stands around here. Live radio.
Ade du Edles Mundlein, which means...
Goodbye, sweet red mouth.
Yes, yeah.
once again, I'm sorry. I didn't catch
Goodbye, that. Sweet red mouth.
Oh, okay.
That was Molly Quinn, our soprano, with 2 mute cornets now, played by Kiri and Nathaniel.
Ah, all right. Wonderful.
And just a word about the mute cornetto. It's a straight instrument, single piece, and the mouthpiece is actually carved into the bore of the instrument, so it has a much more mellow, softer sound, as you'll, I think, hear.
Ade, du edles Mündlein rot, lass nicht länger in dir Not. Nur 1000 Schirr ist meine Kron. Soll Venus Sonne gibt mir zu
music provided by Dark Horse Concert. They're performing in Palo Alto on Friday, Berkeley on Saturday, and Sunday here in San Francisco. I think we have time for one more piece. We have another vocal piece coming, I believe. Could you explain what we might be hearing, Greg Ingalls?
Sure. This is another piece by Thomas Zähle called Frisch auf mein Herz for soprano and 2 mute cornets. It's from a collection of works that specifies 2 soprano parts, 1 instrumental, 1 vocal, or if you have 2 instruments, you could do it with just 2 instruments or with 2 voices. It's kind of very flexible, which is the whole point of our concert, that they're all kind of one unit, and depending on what they had back then, it's whatever church, that you could program it however you needed for your Sunday service.
Very nice. We're still scrambling for some music here. So let me just give you some more information about these concerts. The Friday concert in Palo Alto is at First Lutheran Church on Homer Street, Saturday in Berkeley at St. John's Presbyterian College Avenue, and then here in San Francisco on Sunday afternoon at 4 at St. Mark's Lutheran Church. Dark Horse Concert, Unbroken Consort, The Marriage of Voice and Brass in 17th Century Germany. And one final performance of them here live in the KLW studios.
Frisch auf mein Herz, verzage nicht, denn alle Gott noch lebet. Helfe frei, sobald sitzt, dass man in Sorgen schwebet. Wird in Zu
Jolie Greenleaf, as vocalist, Kiri Tollickson, cornetist, and Nathaniel Cox on cornet, along with Webb Wiggins at the harpsichord, for a live studio performance here on KALW's Open Air, the Dark Horse Concert, Unbroken Consort, the Marriage of Voice and Brass in 17th Century Germany. Concerts are this weekend in Palo Alto, Berkeley, and San Francisco. Information for these concerts is at their website, sfems.org. Still to come here on Open Air, I'll talk with Andrew Nance about Harbor at the New Conservatory Theater, and Jake Heggie and I will talk about Dead Man Walking, the opera that was premiered some 15 years ago with the San Francisco Opera, in the production that is now at the Yerba Buena Center this weekend. The conductor laureate of the San Francisco Symphony is back in town for performances through this Saturday evening, concluding a second week of concerts with the glorious work by Johannes Brahms, A German Requiem. I had the pleasure to talk with Maestro Herbert Blomstedt last year when he was in town. That interview, by the way, is archived at kalw.org. The Decca recording label had just released a massive 15-CD set of Herbert Blomstedt, the San Francisco years, documenting, under superb audio conditions, highlights from his decade at the helm of the symphony from 1985 to 1995. The Brahms Requiem is being performed this weekend, is also part of that 15-CD set, by the way. It won the 1996 Grammy for Best Choral Performance. The two soloists for this weekend's performances of Brahms' Ein Deutsches Requiem are baritone Christian Gerhaher, who is making his San Francisco Symphony debut with these performances, and soprano Ruth Zizak, who has not performed with the San Francisco since her debut in September of 1992, and that was for Mahler's Second Symphony, with Maestro Blomstedt on the podium, which was subsequently recorded by Decca and, coincidentally, is included in the same box set. Happy coincidences all. Ruth joins me in studio to talk about her time both here in San Francisco and elsewhere. Welcome to Open Air, Ruth Zizak.
Welcome.
It sounds like the collaboration with Maestro Blomstedt has been not only long, but lasting.
Absolutely. In 92, it was the first time I was in the United States, and also the first time I worked with Maestro Herbert Blomstedt.
And that was the first time working with him in such a massive work, too.
Yes, of course.
You also did this same Brahms with Blomstedt in Bamberg.
In Bamberg, and I did it many years ago also in Sweden, in Uppsala and in Stockholm.
And so you have a long history with this work. Tell us about your relationship with Johannes Brahms, and specifically the Deutsches Requiem.
Mm-hmm. Well, the Deutsches Requiem is one of the most important works for choir. And the soloists don't have special arias. They are just one wheel, one part of the whole thing. This is perhaps very important to know, especially for a soloist.
Mm-hmm. Well, it doesn't have the largest role in the work. Just in the fifth movement, you're quite featured, a very, very prominent role in this langsam or slow fifth movement. Tell us about the text that you'll be singing in that fifth movement, where Brahms pulls his text.
Well, this fifth movement was put into the whole piece very much later. I think one reason was because his mother died and he completed the whole thing like this. And what, for my opinion, is very important is to comfort people when they lost a person. And this is also, the text is talking about this. It has, ihr habt nun Traurigkeit, that means now you are sad because you lost someone. But there is the idea of resurrection also. These are the words the soprano is giving. And the choir has another text that speaks about comforting and like a mother does.
Mm, interesting.
That makes it very human-like, not When you think of the Latin text of a Requiem, the humans are not specifically meant.
I think even Brahms had mentioned that he wasn't happy entirely with calling it a German Requiem. He even wanted to call it a human Requiem.
Yes.
Well, let's hear an excerpt from that fifth movement of the Deutsches Requiem of Johannes Brahms, also from the 15-CD set recording on the Decca label, Herbert Blomstedt conducting, and Elisabeth Norberg-Schultz singing. Comforting text of comfort and resurrection, that excerpt from the fifth movement of Ein Deutsches Requiem, music of Johannes Brahms. You just heard Elisabeth Norberg-Schultz in that brief excerpt. It's from the 15-CD set on the Decca label, Herbert Blomstedt, the San Francisco years. My guest Ruth Zizak will be singing that role this weekend. Ruth, that's really just an amazing ethereal quality that one has to have to pull that off as a soprano. Now, have you noticed that you've had to change the way you approach the role as the years go on?
Oh, yes, of course. Well, first of all, I thought the soprano part has the idea of an angelic voice, of an angelic quality, but also it should get the warmth of the mother aspect. Mm. So both should come together. And this, I hope, develops.
Mm. I mentioned that this is from the excerpt we heard is just from that CD set. You sang the Mahler Second Symphony that is also included on that 15-CD set. And a wonderful coincidence there. You also recently sang the Beethoven Missa Solemnis with Blomstedt in L.A. and Berlin. What were those performances like?
Oh, well, this is also a masterpiece, but much more different, because Beethoven is a composer who always fights for solutions. And when you are singing this and making the music, there is so much tension, and you are always trying to get this goal.
Sure. You're also such a multifaceted artist. I mean, you've enjoyed triumphs on the operatic stage in recital and in chamber settings, as well as being a soloist with a full orchestra and chorus behind you. Now, this is always an interesting question. Do you have a preference for the type of way you like to perform or the venue that you like to perform in?
Well, one of my preferences is chamber music and doing Lieder. But the biggest, largest preference is to do everything, to have the opportunity really to do everything, because it is the most important thing for my voice, for my fantasy, and for my creativity as an artist.
I noticed that there was some Poulenc on your performance schedule. Are you more comfortable in the classical repertoire, in the romantic repertoire, or are you have a comfort level in the contemporary world as well?
I do a little contemporary. Most of the time I'm singing classical repertoire or also Baroque repertoire.
A busy spring ahead with, among other things, some Bach in May. You collaborated with Ton Koopman to record the complete vocal works of Johann Sebastian Bach with the Amsterdam Baroque Orchestra and Choir. That must have been a massive project.
Yes, of course. Yeah.
And you also singing as soloist for Bruckner's Fourth Symphony in June. A particular performance or concert hall that you enjoy performing in above others?
Oh, that's a good question. Yes, one of the most beautiful halls are the Musikverein in Vienna.
Lovely to hear. And as an audience member, I've enjoyed hearing things in that hall as well.
Yes. I sang here before in 92 when it was renovated. So, Davis Hall, I mean. And so I'm looking forward very much to sing here again. It's a huge hall and it must have a fantastic acoustic too.
Ruth Zizak performing as soloist with baritone Christian Gerhahar, Maestro Herbert Blomstedt conducting the San Francisco Symphony and the San Francisco Symphony Chorus as prepared by Ragnar Bolin. The concerts are tonight, Friday, and Saturday at 8 p.m. in Davies Symphony Hall. Information at sfsymphony.org. Ruth Zizak, I wish you a splendid performance and a spectacular spring. It looks like you're going to be quite busy.
Thank you very much.
Still to come here on KLW, we'll be talking with Andrew Nance about his starring role in Harbor, which is at the New Conservatory Theater. Composer Jake Heggie's landmark work Dead Man Walking, with a libretto by Terrence McNally, returns to the city which gave its premiere some 15 years ago. This time, not by the San Francisco Opera, which commissioned it, but rather by Opera Parallèle, under the direction of Nicole Paimont. Dead Man Walking is based on Sister Helen Prejean's 1993 memoir, which tells of her time working with death row inmates at the Louisiana State Penitentiary, where she developed a particular relationship with one of the inmates. You may also recall that Sister Helen's memoir was the subject of the celebrated 1995 film starring Susan Sarandon and Sean Penn. It's a pleasure to welcome composer Jake Heggie back to our airwaves to talk about this production. In addition to orchestral, chamber, and choral works, the very busy Mr. Heggie has penned a plethora of art songs written for the likes and sometimes at the behest of Frederica von Stade and Joyce DiDonato, who originated the roles respectively of the mother and Sister Helen in Dead Man Walking here in San Francisco, Nathan Gunn, Audra McDonald, and Catherine Cook, who is also in the San Francisco production of Dead Man Walking, and who, among many others, Jake operas include Moby Dick, which, in addition to being partially commissioned by the San Francisco Opera, was telecast as part of PBS's Great Performances 40th Anniversary series. His other operas include Three Decembers, To Hell and Back, and Out of Darkness, a triptych of Holocaust stories. Jake, welcome back to Open Air.
Great to be here. Thank you, David.
Well, let's first talk about how you've had to adjust Dead Man Walking, which, congratulations, has had some 40 productions mounted around the world, from a large opera house to a smaller venue like the Yerba Buena Center and Opera Parallèle.
Well, what's been amazing on the journey of this opera is, first of all, I had only ever considered that it could be done in a big opera house with a large orchestra, with a big cast of large voices and big chorus. And I mean, that's how it was conceived, as an American grand opera. And over the years, different companies started coming forward and saying, well, our pit isn't big enough. We really want to do the piece, but it's not big enough. And so a reduced orchestration was created, actually as a graduate student project by students at the University of Lincoln, Oklahoma.
Hey, way to shove off the work on that one, Jake. Nice.
Well, you know, reimagining an orchestration for a piece is like mind-bending once you have done it, you know, and put it aside.
Well, sure.
To revisit
plus, you also have such a personal connection to it.
Exactly. Yeah. So it takes perspective, which, you know, and I'm also very busy, like, writing all the pieces you were talking about.
Yeah.
But a reduced orchestration sort of developed, and different size productions started happening, and then universities started doing it, and different size companies. And at one point, a couple of years ago, a company in Boston did it called Boston Opera Collaborative, and they had like 35 instruments in the orchestra and a stage, you know, basically 10 by 10, and they used people as scenery mostly, and just a few props, and I was amazed how powerful it was and how overwhelming. And so I suddenly realized this is a very flexible piece, and also for a piece like this to have a life, it does have to be flexible, especially today with the challenges that the arts are facing. So the fact that it is flexible, that it does have a different size orchestration and can work in different size hall, has worked to the piece's advantage. And so it's been done, I think, many more times than if it had been locked into that sort of grand opera and we can only do it big.
Hmm.
What Opera Parallel has done is taken it to another level, because Nicole Paiement, who I think is a genius, not only a brilliant conductor, but a brilliant artist, brilliant musician, and a great colleague, she's further distilled the score down to work for 31 players. And I sat it on a rehearsal last week, and I was just amazed that I didn't really miss anything. It was so well done, and the players are so expert. And then Brian Stauffenbiel, who is directing and creating the new production, has this wonderful vision that takes advantage of technology and projections, as well as minimal scenery and a lot of lighting effects, so that the focus is not on a lot of big set pieces, but on the characters and their journeys. Specifically. And that, I think, is really thrilling. And that's a new direction that opera productions have been going for a number of years. And I find that very exciting because, of course, the interest is in the human stories. And if you get lost in scenery and extraneous production and other things, you lose sight of the actual drama and story itself. And I think Opera Parallel is kind of brilliant and well-known for this.
Mm.
And Opera Parallel is part of a wave of smaller companies at a grassroots level that are bringing new and established works to a community in a different way, in a different theater than the opera house, showing that it is a really flexible art form. But we're so lucky to have companies like Opera Parallel, West Edge, all of these companies in the Bay Area that actually bring opera to a broader level, and then people can go to the big house too, you know.
Right.
So it actually all works together.
Well, you mentioned the very human story that is involved in Dead Man Walking. For those that need a refresher, could you give us the synopsis version of the story?
It's about a young nun in Louisiana who becomes the spiritual advisor to a condemned man on death row. And she goes to visit him, gets to know him, his family. She gets to know the family of the teenagers that he murdered. And she's sort of at an emotional and spiritual crisis of her own, as he is in a huge crisis emotionally, morally, spiritually, as to what is the right thing for him to do when his instinct is just to survive. The families have their own moment of crisis and transformation. And I think it's a huge journey for the audience to take with Sister Helen. It was very important to us in writing it that we not create a polemic where you're told this is good and this is bad. It was important for us just to tell the story well and draw people into it so that they could experience it themselves in three dimensions and come to their own conclusions. But I think it has the reputation of being the death penalty opera. And actually, there isn't a debate about the death penalty in the opera itself. It's the death penalty that raises the stakes to life or death at every turn and in every scene. And I think high stakes is what opera is about. It's what raises the emotional plane so great that it makes sense for people to sing rather than speak. And the drama is so big that it can fill an opera house.
Mm.
And it's so powerful. And it requires really great singing actors. And that's another thing that Opera Parallel has done, is they've brought in a tremendous cast between Jennifer Rivera and Michael Mays and Talese Trevine and Bob Orth, who was in the original, Catherine Cook, who was in the original but is now singing the role of the mother.
John Dykers, too.
John Dykers. It's an amazing... Philip Skinner. It's an amazing cast. Yeah. We're very, very lucky. But it's an incredible transformative journey, and I think a very powerful emotional one. And I just am excited that the city is going to experience the piece this time with a new vision, with new resources, in a different space, and with a different production and a different sound from the orchestra. I think that's very, very exciting.
It's not an easy story to tell, especially as there's no question about this guy's guilt, and mm-hmm. you can have very strong opinions, and there's pain all around.
But I think part of what's brilliant about Terrence McNally's amazing libretto is that he starts the opera off with the crime. So there is no question in our mind who did it and what he did. Mm. And we start from a place of outrage. Because the question, of course, is not, should we be killing innocent people who are wrongly accused and in prison? Of course we shouldn't be killing innocent people. But what do we do when someone is truly, truly guilty of something so heinous and awful? So that's the big question and the moral dilemma that's posed to us by the way Terrence has set up the piece. We see him do it. We know who it is. We see what he does. And now what do we as a society do? How do we handle this? Mm. And that's the big journey that Sister Helen and the audience will go on.
How did that original collaboration with Terrence McNally and the consideration of this as operatic material come about?
It was Terrence McNally's idea, and he's a great man of the theater, multiple Tony Award winner. He'd written not only great plays like Master Class, Lips Together, Teeth Apart, Love, Valor, Compassion, but also he's written books for musicals like Ragtime, Kiss of the Spider Woman, The Full Monty. So he knows about music and theater working together on the stage, and he also is a lifelong opera fan, and he was looking for a story that would be a real American drama that would not only feel of our time but would feel timeless, something that would feel American but universal. And he said he was walking down the street one day and just Dead Man Walking popped into his head. And so it was his idea, and Sister Helen immediately gave us permission. She was very enthusiastic right from the start. So it was a really remarkable confluence of events, because of course I was still working as a PR writer and at the San Francisco Opera, and it was Lotfi Mansouri, who was then general director, who pulled me out and said, you're going to be our first composer in residence, and I'm going to send you to New York to meet Terrence McNally, and you're going to write an opera for the main stage.
Wow.
Well, my first reaction was, who are you talking to?
Right.
But, you know, he believed, he was a real impresario and a visionary, and he really believed in finding talent wherever it might be hidden. And even if that meant it was on his own staff, in the PR marketing department as a writer. And so he pulled me out and sent me to New York. Now, at the time when he asked me to do it, it was a comedy that he actually had in mind. He was hoping for something light and frothy and bubbly for the millennium.
Dead Man Walking! Exclamation mark.
Exactly. So imagine his surprise when Terrence McNally and I said, well, we've come up with a topic for the opera.
Well,
but his mouth fell open at first. But I think it was because, like me, it was the last thing he expected, and yet he immediately recognized it as a brilliant idea, and it was a brilliant idea.
Hmm. Speaking of Terrence's words and your music, there's a marvelous sextet in Act One where all of the characters confront Sister Helen. Let's talk about the process of writing a sextet after we hear this brief excerpt. What are we going to hear in this sextet?
You're going to hear the moment when Sister Helen, after she's been at the pardon board hearing and she's heard his mother state her case, she finally has the courage to go up and introduce herself to the parents of the murdered teenagers. She never thought they would want to be in touch with her, since she was the spiritual advisor to the man that killed their children. And so they're all waiting for the verdict, and she walks out to meet them, and they sing of their grief, and it evolves into a big sextet where all the parents are singing the same music.
Music from Dead Man Walking by Jake Heggie, and then more with the composer.
Thank you.
an excerpt from the Sextet, Act One, Dead Man Walking, music by Jake Heggie, libretto by Terrence McNally. Marvelous stuff. Jake, I'm reminded of words that Peter Schaeffer, the playwright, put into the words of Mozart when he's trying to explain to the Austrian emperor how a playwright would have to write those lines out one at a time. If they said them all at once, it would be impossible to understand, whereas a composer can put them could mount them one on top of each other and create perfect harmony.
Well, that's the magic of opera, of course. That's what one of the things we all love about opera the most is the fact that you can have these amazing ensembles where many people are singing at once and you still understand what they're saying, even if you don't get every word. And that's because it's the emotional language that's coming across through the music. You don't have to know every single word. And if I've done my job well, too, you'll still get a sense of the character and the line of the character and the emotional world of the character as they move forward as well. I love ensembles and if they develop organically out of the texture so that it serves the drama and it moves the story along. Very, very exciting. I think that it's a very exciting moment for an audience when an ensemble emerges and suddenly all these people are singing about something and you still understand what's going on. You're still in the emotional sphere of all those people.
Do you find writing a sextet like that torturous or exciting? Or
oh, no, very, very exciting. It's when I finally figure it out.
Rather like a puzzle, I imagine.
Well, yeah, but this one, you know, I remember writing this sextet all those years ago, and it just, once the main tune emerged, this "you don't know what it's like," and I realized that every single parent is going to be singing that to Sister Helen, because they're all parents who have either lost a child or are about to lose their child, so they're all united in this, and it became this big statement of grief from all these parents in a very Baroque fashion. So underneath it all is this sort of very Baroque harmonic and rhythmic thing of just this dee-dum, 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 almost like a heartbeat.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Then this tune over on top of it. That's the remnants of my flu talking. it sort of developed and emerged. I wrote that whole scene in about an afternoon because it was so clear when it happened.
That's exciting.
So yeah, sometimes it takes a while to get there, but then once it emerges, it's very exciting, and usually it will write itself very quickly.
Hmm. Well, toy, toy, toy for these productions.
Yeah,
Opera
thank
Parallel
you.
Under... Nicole Paimont, directed the production directed by and created by Brian Stauffenbiel.
Yes.
And the productions are Friday and Saturday at 8, a matinee this coming Sunday at 2. Information which we'll put at our website, this link, operaparallel.org. We're going to go out with another aria from the opera, This Journey. Tell us what we're going to hear on this.
Well, this is the central aria for the character of Sister Helen, and it really is not only describing the journey that she's about to embark on, but the audience is about to embark on as well. She's in her car, and she's driving to Angola prison for the first time to meet this man. And along the way, like we do in life, sometimes you have those moments where you realize there's going to be your life before this moment and your life after this moment. This is a turning point. And she realizes that in this moment and sings about the journey that she's on.
Music of Jake Heggie. Jake, thanks for coming in today.
You're very welcome.
Susan Graham singing This Journey in the role of Sister Helen Prejean, a role that would be sung by Jennifer Rivera this weekend for performances of the Jake Heggie, Terrence McNally opera Dead Man Walking at the Yerba Buena Center this weekend. The New Conservatory Theater Center is presenting the West Coast premiere of the sharp and timely new comedy Harbor by Chad Begulin, directed by Conservatory founder and artistic director Ed Decker. In the leading role of Ted is former Conservatory director Andrew Nance, who was last seen in the Conservatory in the acclaimed performance of Del Shore's Yellow last season. Andrew has also appeared at the Conservatory in Doubt, for which he was nominated for a Bay Area Theater Critics Circle Best Actor nomination, I Am My Own Wife, for which he was awarded Best Solo Performance by that august group, among other shows and there and elsewhere. And he also served as 18 years as the New Conservatory Theater Center's Conservatory Director, where he led all educational school programs and workshops for youth and adults. It's a pleasure to welcome him back to our studios. Hey, Andrew.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Well, let's start with a brief synopsis of Harbor.
Okay. Harbor takes place in Sag Harbor, Long Island, and I play Ted, the polished architect in town, and I have a husband named Kevin, and we live sort of the a-gay lifestyle, and Kevin's ne'er-do-well sister shows up with her teenage daughter, and cultures collide.
Okay, well, the play's promo pictures remind me of somewhat of Modern Family or
yes.
Will and Grace. Are there similarities
yes.
there?
There's a lot of that type of humor, but it does have a little bit more depth as the play goes on. It starts off very farcical, a lot of broad jokes, broad comedy, takes to the audience, that sort of thing. But as the play gets going, it does get a little bit more serious.
Well, there has to be some great writing involved because a four-time Tony nominee, Chad Begulin, is the playwright. His works include Disney's Aladdin, for which he received the Tony nomination for Best Book and Best Original Score, The Wedding Singer, for which he was nominated for a Tony Award for Best Book and Original Score. He also wrote the lyrics for the Broadway musical Elf. So there's got to be a lot in there.
Yeah. He's quite a good writer, I think. I believe it might be his first time out writing a play for large audiences, but I think he's done a really good job.
It's being directed by the founder and artistic director of the New Conservatory Theater Center, Ed Decker, with whom you've had a long time association over the years.
Yeah.
What's his directing style like?
Very precise. He's German, so it's so wonderful because he comes in. First, he wants all the actors to know all their lines on day one, which is hard to do. We all make a valiant attempt at doing it. And he has the entire show blocked out or choreographed, so you know exactly where you sit, when you sit, as a structure. And then the actors might say, well, this doesn't feel right to me. Or he may say, just watching it now, it's different than it is in my head. So he changes it. But it's right away, like within the first week, you have a format of where to go on stage.
Mm-hmm. Well, share with us a little bit about the rest of your castmates.
Okay. Scott Cox plays my husband, Kevin, and he and I have worked together both on and off the stage in at New Conservatory. He worked there for a number of years, I believe in marketing. And then we were in a play by Terrence McNally years ago called Crucifixion. And that was a play that Terrence McNally wrote for New Conservatory, keeping all of the, I think there were maybe 10 of us in mind when he wrote it. So it was quite
interesting. Terrence McNally being the librettist for Dead Man Walking.
Oh, interesting. Kagi. That's right. Yeah, that's right.
All ties in together for
that's
this
exactly
show.
That's exactly right. Oh, cool. And then Jenna Herz plays the teenager, and she, in fact, is a teenager. She goes to Redwood High, and she has done a fair amount of acting, mostly in musicals, and I believe this is her first professional play, and she is getting a lot of notice for her her comic timing and her strength on stage. So people are really singling her out a lot. And then Terry Whipple is sort of the cuckoo clock woman sister of my husband, and she, I think, just does a lovely job of just being a nut job. She's a joy to watch on stage, and you just never know what's going to come out of her mouth, so it's fun.
Speaking of watching on stage, scenic design is by Devin Casper. What will we see?
A beautiful set. It's our living room, sort of supposed to look like a very ornate, I don't want to say Victorian, but stylish home on Long Island. So it's a lovely set, and there's some surprises to it, which is fun to watch. Because we go to different places in the town, and so there's a theatrical trick that they use to do that. So it's kind of cool to watch.
So there's back to the story. There's some confrontational episodes. There's resolution, perhaps, but a lot of comedy mixed in as well.
Yes, absolutely.
What do you want people to take away from the play?
Well, I would say the play is about growing up. We all start off very shallow. You know, these guys are sort of, I think I might have said, the A-gays in town. They like to party. They like to shop. They like to travel. But the depth of their relationship is not that great, nor is their depth of friendships that great with other people. So by the end of the play, all of them decide in very different ways to kind of roll up their sleeves and grow up a little bit.
Critics have called it amusing, highly engrossing, and unpredictable.
Yeah.
I guess our audience members can be the judge, or better yet, don't judge it. Just go see Harbor at the New Conservatory Theater Center. Information at nctcsf.org. We'll have that link at our website. It runs through March 1st at the New Conservatory Theater right at the base of Van Ness and Market. Andrew, I wish you a successful run on this, and I'm looking forward to catching the show.
Thank you so much.
We'll see you again soon. That runs through March 1st, Harbor at the New Conservatory Theater Center. A reminder, too, that there's another wonderful concert coming up this weekend. It's a jam-packed weekend, as you've heard just from today's program. At the Center for New Music on Taylor Street, the Sierra Ensemble will be performing a Persian premiere and some European gems. The Sierra Ensemble is Anita Felix on violin, Janice Lieberman on horn, and Mark Steiner on piano. Information at sierraensemble.com. Music of the premiere performance of Ida Shirazi's trio for violin, horn, and piano, as well as works by Brahms, Strauss, and Prokofiev. sierraensemble.com. I'm David LaTulipe. A reminder that our show, Open Air, is archived at our website, kalw.org. My thanks to Neil Swinkles for greasing the wheels of Open Air.